The coolness of the nights is what makes this area a magical place. In a good year, when all these elements combine in proper proportion, all of us in this region celebrate once again the vast miracle which takes place at harvest time. Bernard Gineste, the co-owner of Chateau Margaux, tells us of a typical menu served to his pickers at harvest.
First, the soup that we call the garbure, which is a soup with lard and bread and cauliflower and bacon and everything, yes. You see, and it is very good. Yes, also charcuterie, you know, hams and sausages, yes. So forth.
That's only the beginning.
Yes, just the beginning, because there will be three or four other courses, such as the roasted ducks, and we put on a spit about 40 ducks in the same time. You know, during the harvest, we have about 12 to 15 women working in the kitchen, and we have a special room with a special kitchen for the cooking of the wine pickers.
And what comes after the duck?
After the duck, well, there are some other good things. For instance, a piece of beef with sauce, you know, that we call the bœuf mod or yes. Something like that. And also a salad and a pie, pâté and so forth, and cheese and also strawberries.
Now we must travel 15 or so miles northwest of Bordeaux to one of the great historic monuments of the area, the little town of Saint-Emilion. Here, the fine wine which bears the name of this town is produced. Saint-Emilion is one of the most ancient and most picturesque places a traveler can possibly find. The red wines of Saint-Emilion are grown in an area not more than a few miles square. The base of the soil is pure solid rock, a spongy sort of rock to be sure, so the drainage is swift, yet the roots of the vines remain moist. The wines of Saint-Emilion are the fullest of all the Bordeaux wines. Their bouquet, however, is generally not the quality of the Medoc wines, nor are they equal in finesse. Nevertheless, they have an excellence all of their own. In 1961, Chateau Cheval Blanc produced one of the greatest Bordeaux on record. Adjoining Saint-Emilion is a district called Pomerolles, whose wine is noted for its distinctive bouquet. It is generally agreed that although the best wine of Pomerolles comes from Chateau Petrus, many nearby vineyards can vie for top distinction. The wines of Pomerolles have much of the quality of a fine Medoc. What distinguishes them, aside from their characteristic bouquet, is what we call their fatness. The wine fills the mouth, the result of natural glycerin. It is a big, soft wine without the piercing body of a Medoc or a fine Burgundy. To recapitulate now, what we call Bordeaux wines consists of those of the Médoc, of Margaux, Saint-Julien, Pauillac, Saint-Estèphe, all of which are part of the Médoc area. Then there are the wines of Saint-Emilion of Pomerolles, which brings us to the remaining wines classified as Bordeaux, the Graves and the Sauternes. The vineyards of Graves extend for some 35 miles along the western bank of the Garonne River, but it is a narrow strip barely 5 miles wide. It is curious to leave the outskirts of the city of Bordeaux and suddenly in a suburb to come upon the greatest vineyard-producing Grave, Chateau Brion. There is both a white Grave and a red Grave. This vineyard of Chateau Brion was producing Bordeaux's greatest red wine in the Middle Ages, when the English called it claret, as they still do today. Here is a friend of mine, the Duke of Bedford, who recalls what it was like to be a son in the great English house. Not in the Middle Ages, to be sure, but quite recently.
Tell me, Ian, when you were a boy at Woburn, what wines were served?
My always greatest memory were always of clarets. There seemed to have been always many more clarets that were drunk.
That's natural because of the tradition of that claret is held in all of the great homes.
But the terrible thing is that one never asked or questioned exactly what was being drunk. It was always the perfect match for whatever was happening. And
in decanters.
In decanters.
Yes.
Always in decanters. And now I've got a French wife, one sees the bottle.
We were discussing the wines of that section of Bordeaux called Grave, which literally means gravel. The abundance of gravel at the vineyards of Chateau Brion is often given as one of the reasons for the high quality of the wine it produces. Not only is drainage swift and thorough on this soil, but the porous pebbles act as a mulch and also as a reflector of the sun, sending its warmth upward toward the heavy bunches of grapes. Chateaubriand has a distinguished history. Talleyrand was once its owner, and after Napoleon was defeated, Talleyrand was sent to the Congress of Vienna in 1815 to discuss peace terms. Talleyrand was a wise old politician, and he used the art of wine and food to accomplish his diplomatic ends. His chef was the famous Carême. Talleyrand's wine came from his Chateaubriand. Serving his excellent food and his superb wines, Talleyrand gained great concessions for France at his dinner table during his sojourn in Vienna. It is interesting to note that the present owner of Chateaubriand is also a diplomat, an American, Douglas Dillon. This is what the growers of wine in the Bordeaux area fear most: a sudden heavy storm in autumn, and especially if the rain turns to ice. The hailstones can smash the vineyards disastrously, and so the grower must know just when to harvest his grapes. If he picks the grapes before they're fully ripe, their acidity will throw the wine out of balance. If he waits too long, the grapes may rot. A matter of a day or two can make all the difference in the world. This art of timing or judgment is best seen in the making of that glorious sweet wine called Sauterne. There is a final S to the word Sauterne, though some American vineyards, who have no right to label their wine Sauterne, do so spelling the word without its final S. The village of Sauterne is the capital of the district where this wine is made, some 20 miles southeast of Bordeaux. And less than a mile up the long hill leading out of the village of Sauterne is the world-famous Chateau d'Yquem, Y-Q-U-E-M, Yquem. For centuries, this chateau has produced the greatest Sauterne. Harvest time at Chateau d'Yquem is a drama of thrilling suspense. What one witnesses is a race between the moment when the grape has achieved its state of being thoroughly overripe and the killing, freezing rains which may sweep across the vineyards at any moment during this late autumn season. The growers in Sauterne pace their vineyards every day, gathering bunches of grapes and analyzing their sugar content in long test tubes. If the overripening is allowed to go too far, the bouquet of the wine will be lost. If the grape is picked too soon, the wine will lack that extra richness, the sugar and alcoholic content which the great Sauterne are expected to have. The grape must achieve what the French call pourriture noble, or the noble rot. You may have seen this noble rot on overripe grapes and call the grapes just plain rotten. But in Sauterne, with the appearance of this mold, the growers know that the moment of decision is fast approaching. The skins shrivel, the water content lessens, but at the same time, the sugar content of the grape increases. The natural pectins and glycerins increase, and it is this that gives the wine of Sauterne its celebrated suavité and smoothness, its unctuous richness, making it the greatest dessert wine of all. At harvest time, the grapes have collapsed, shriveled, and are covered with mold. Now they are picked carefully, not in clusters, but one by one. These grapes are not a pretty sight to behold. In fact, it's hard to imagine that from these objects, the golden nectar which is Sauterne will eventually arise. Now, you mustn't get the impression that Chateau d'Yquem is the only vineyard making Sauterne, but it is certainly one of the greatest. In the neighboring district of Barsac, excellent Sauterne is also made, and in certain years, the Sauterne of Barsac, notably the product of Chateau Climens and Chateau Coutet, even surpass Chateau d'Yquem. Sauterne is the only quality white wine that could be iced. Other delicate dry white wines, served at this icy temperature, would numb the taste of the wine. A great Sauterne is, I imagine, very close to what the ambrosia of the gods must have been. It warms the heart, loosens the tongue, and lightens the spirit, as indeed all fine wines do. Cognac is a brandy. That is a distillation of wine. And cognac is the most famous of brandies, the other being Armagnac. Cognac is found in a region northwest of Bordeaux. There is a town named Cognac, and the surrounding area also bears the same name. This fine brandy has become a symbol of the richness of civilized living. You inhale its heady aroma. You sip its poignant flavor, and life itself becomes a lovely thing to enjoy. Sometimes people forget that cognac is a product of the grape, since the final product is so far removed from the bouquet and taste of wine. A marvelous transformation takes place somewhere between the vineyard and the bottle of brandy you buy. I would almost say a transfiguration takes place, because the wine from which cognac is made is almost unpalatable. A local saying in the vineyards of cognac is that the best cognac comes from the worst wine, and yet the wine must be carefully made, for any fault in the wine will turn up in the cognac. Briefly, this is how cognac is made. The winemaking proceeds much as it does in other regions. But in cognac, the wine is not permitted to age. It is heated in a massive copper kettle. After a time, the distillation of the wine rises in a vapor. This is condensed by cooling, and a milky liquid is formed. The liquid goes through the same process. After a second distillation and some purification, the infant cognac, raw and unsophisticated, is at last ready for the special barrel in which it will be aged. I wanted to listen to my friend Francois Hein, who heads one of the famous houses devoted to the making of cognac.
Cognac is a brandy made out of wine, and wine coming from a very delimited area called the cognac area. Brandy can be made out of any kind of wine, but it is not cognac because it has to be made with the cognac wines. Why is our wines in the cognac districts different from the other wines? It is a question of climate and soil. The aging of cognac is taking place in oak wood casks. And we use, in this district, we use the oak from Limousin. Limousin is a part of France about 70, 80 miles east of here. The cognac is aging in contact with the oak wood and also in contact with air through the pores of the wood. And it is this combined action of wood and air on a newly made cognac that is giving the aging.
Here is the Duke of Montesquieu to talk to you about that other delightful brandy, Armagnac.
Pierre, what is the difference between cognac and Armagnac?
First of all, Armagnac is produced in Gascony. Secondly, the distillation is quite different. And the third point is that Armagnac is kept in oaks grown in Gascony.
How about its production?
The whole Armagnac production is about 10% of the cognac.
How about its history?
History is a very old history. It's the oldest brandy of France. It was the brandy known in 1416 during the war between Armagnacs and Burgundies. The history closer to us, musketeers always drank Armagnac for the great fights they had for the King of France.
Couché sous la treille, plus heureux qu'un roi, toujours ma bouteille à côté de moi. Jamais je m'embrouille, car chaque matin, je me débarbouille dans un verre de vin. Joyeux enfants de la Bourgogne, je n'ai jamais eu de guignon. Quand je vois...
There's that song to remind me that I must tell you about the great wines of Burgundy. Burgundy is a region of France that stretches about 200 miles from the cathedral town of Auxerre, south of Fontainebleau, down to the outskirts of the city of Lyon. There's an old saying, port is for citizens, claret for gentlemen, champagne for duchesses, but Burgundy is for kings. Winemaking in Burgundy goes back more than 2,000 years. It is an ancient area, an ancient soil. At one time, Emperor Charlemagne owned vineyards in Burgundy. The system of ownership in the vineyards of Burgundy is quite different from that of Bordeaux. In Bordeaux, the more important vineyards belong to a chateau whose proprietor owns the vineyard. In Burgundy, there are no chateaus in the Bordeaux sense, and a man may own, and usually does, own bits and pieces of a number of widely scattered vineyards. If the owner bottles his own wine, thus safeguarding the authenticity of the wine, it is called estate bottling. It gives the same guarantee of authenticity that chateau bottling does in Bordeaux. In Burgundy, I myself own several acres of vineyards scattered in the Côte de Nuit, which produces excellent wine. One of the greatest of Burgundian vineyards is Chambertin, and its wines in a good year are difficult to surpass. The vineyards of Chambertin are grown on only 32 acres, but these 32 acres are world famous for the quality of wine they produce. But here I must add a note of caution. In Bordeaux, when you buy a Chateau bottled wine, you may be sure that you are getting the vintage marked on the label. It makes some people angry, but nevertheless it is true that in Burgundy wines may bear false labels of old vintages. It is, as I've said earlier, always better to buy estate bottlings of a reputable grower of wines, or the wines of a reliable shipper. In Burgundy, before the year 1936, a great deal of blending of wines took place. That is, the wine from the bulk-producing areas in southern France or from Algeria was mixed with wine bearing the great Burgundian names on the labels. The result was an indifferent wine, or even a mediocre one. The local governing boards, established after 1936, watched for frauds, but they still do occur. What the buyer must look for on the label is, of course, the stamp Appellation Contrôlée. Here is Monsieur Tinlot, an inspector of fraud for the Appellation Contrôlée, who will tell us about his duties.
Le service de la répression des fraudes est un service qui a pour mission de protéger les consommateurs.
An inspector for the prevention of fraud is charged with the responsibility of protecting the consumer against misrepresentations. I am the chief inspector of the southeast of France. The wine regions falling under my jurisdiction are the regions of the Beaujolais, the Savoie, and the Côte du Rhône. Controls are applied in two ways. One, by controlling the product itself. The inspectors take samples at the time the wines are offered for sale by the proprietors and or by the wholesale wine merchants. Experts taste the wines, and then a chemical analysis is made. The second method of control is the accounting method. As all growers must declare their production by the 25th of November following the harvest, it is very easy to check the declaration of production made by the grower by seeing that his production does not exceed the acreage he owns. As there is a maximum per acre yield permitted, it is easy to detect any excesses which would go over the quantities that are permitted. The accused is tried in the local court, and if any infringement is found, he can be fined or imprisoned. Last year, there were between 400 to 500 such prosecutions.
Nothing in France is very simple. The French have a passion for classifying and refining. This is true in Burgundy too, of course. The Côte d'Or itself is divided into two sections. To the south of the city of Dijon is the Côte de Nuit. Here is the birthplace of the red regal wines of Chambertin, Musigny, and Romanée. But just a moment. Those are Napoleonic marching songs. And why should they be played just now? Because it was Napoleon who had his troops salute when they marched past one of the great vineyards of the Côte de Nuit, the Clos de Vougeot. Napoleon was passionate about many things, and one of them was wine, especially those that came from this great vineyard and from Chambertin. South of the Côte de Nuit starts the Côte de Beaune, taking in the superb wines of Alex Corton and its great Corton vineyards, producing mainly red but also white wine, called Corton Charlemagne. Speaking of white Burgundy, one must never forget Chablis. Chablis is the name of a quiet, happy little country town, 3 hours' drive south of Paris. The very dry Chablis is the perfect wine to have with oysters or fish. The color of this cool wine should be pale yellow, with a faint green tinge. The smell should be clean and fresh. I also commend to you the white wine of Meursault. These are less well known than many other white Burgundies. Hence they are a good value and are a marvelous all-purpose white wine. The wines of Beaune are characterized by their rounded softness. Bone wines, which are not considered good enough to bear the label of a particular vineyard, are sold in the shops simply as Bone. South of Bone begin the vineyards of Pommard, probably the best known of the Burgundies, because its name is so easy to remember. Another reason is the fact that a great deal of it is produced. We come now to one of the greatest white wine producing vineyards of the world, those which produce the divine Montrachet. But where are we? We are in the village of Puligny. The great vineyards are up behind the town. The great vineyard of Montrachet is on the right of the road, and on the left lies the vineyard with the curious name of Bâtard-Montrachet. Chevalier-Montrachet and Montrachet are the greatest of all white Burgundies and among the greatest white wines in the world. The vineyard of Montrachet itself contains only 19 acres. These 19 acres can scarcely fill the world's demand for Montrachet. 1.5 hours drive south of Montrachet, in the southern Burgundy region of the Beaujolais, we come upon the vineyards that produce the very popular white Burgundies called Puy-Fuissé. Moulin-Avant, along with Fleury and Bruy, have consistently been among the best Beaujolais exported. But in France, the best-known Beaujolais is called Chirouble. Beaujolais is one of the most widely drunk red wines in the world. It is excellent when young, even less than a year old. Most of it is drunk throughout the world as Beaujolais. The better ones would be Beaujolais Superior or Beaujolais Village. The top ones would be sold under the village names. One Beaujolais which stands travel very well indeed is Fleurien, is the most typical Beaujolais available in the United States. Other fine Beaujolais come from the villages of Morgon, where the Chateau de Pizet is situated, and from Bruy, B-R-O-U-I-L-L-Y, Bruy. In hot weather, many of the lighter Beaujolais taste better when chilled, and vintages in the Beaujolais mean less than they do in the heart of Burgundy, in the Côte d'Or, for example. Beaujolais is light and refreshing, and you don't sip Beaujolais, you swallow large draughts of it. This is not true of the other Burgundies, of Corton, for instance, and one would certainly not guzzle the Chambertins or the Cortons. These are definitely to be sipped, to be savored, and each drop cherished, and you will never forget them.
Okay, gang, so chances are there'll never be an emergency ever, ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But just in case, let's talk about a plan.
Okay.
So who's gonna do what? Anyone? Yeah, okay, perfect. We'll figure it out as we go. So, who is going to grab the go bag?
What's a go bag?
It is a bag we do not have that is filled with things we really, really need in an emergency.
Guess we won't have to worry about it then.
Ah, good point. So, we all know who to call if something happens then, right?
I'd have to call Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
And I will try to call all of you, but Greg doesn't have a cell phone, Dad's phone will have a dead battery.
No doubt.
And Julie will be on the phone with Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
Well, this is great. I am so glad that we don't have a plan.
I know.
Winging It is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency, who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Visit ready.gov/kids for tips and information. A public service announcement brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
It is WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM, a special Memorial Day edition of Hear It Wow. And we are joining Alexis Lachine, celebrating the joy of wine and meeting some of the most legendary wine producers of the late 20th century.
It seems to me everyone in the world knows this song. And because of it, everyone knows of Avignon situated on the banks of the Rhone River. In the distance is Châteauneuf-du-Pape, new palace of the Pope, that enormous pile of stone which was built during the time of Philip IV of France in the 13th century. Philip and the Pope in Rome did not get along at all, to put it mildly. So Philip managed to obtain the election of a French Pope, who never went to Rome at all. He went to Avignon and lived in the new castle, the Châteauneuf-du-Pape. The wine which takes its name from this ancient edifice is a blend of many varieties of grapes, and it is this which gives them the body and outstanding flavor which makes Châteauneuf-du-Pape world famous. The nearby district of Tavel, which produces the best dry rosé wine of France for export, is world famous for that cooling, pink wine drunk so much in America during the summer months. but it can be drunk in any season and is a fine luncheon wine. To the southwest of Paris, in the region of the great chateaus, those palaces of kings and nobility, we find the charming wines of the Loire. Vouvray, Chinon, Saumur, Anjou. It is a gentle country, and it produces gentle wines. One of the most distinctive is the dry white wine called Pouilly Fumé. This is not to be confused with Pouilly Fumé of Burgundy. Fumé, of course, means smoke. Across the river from Pouilly Fumé are the vineyards of Sancerre, the home of another delightful clean dry white wine. Sancerre is the very popular wine to be found on all the wine lists of Parisian restaurants. The center for the Loire wines is the city of Tours, in the very heart of the Chateau country. These are not like the wine chateaus found in the Bordeaux region, which indeed are little more than stately country homes. These chateaus of the Loire are magnificent affairs, the homes of kings. The chateaus of Amboise, Chenonceau, and Chambord are world famous. The vineyards of Muscadet are near the city of Nantes, and they are the only classified vineyards in Brittany. Muscadet is growing more and more popular, not only in the restaurants of France, but also abroad. They are excellent with oysters and seafood. Wherever there is a celebration, you're apt to find champagne, that festive wine cherished around the world. Champagne is synonymous with gaiety. But it must be clearly understood that the word champagne rightfully belongs only to those wines which come from the area 17 miles south of the city of Reims, that old cathedral city where the kings of France were crowned. It was here that Joan of Arc led her troops against the English. And during the First World War, decisive battles were fought through the vineyards above the Marne River, which flows through the lovely countryside of the Champagne area. But it is the extraordinary wine which is produced here which has made the area world famous. Champagne is made by a fascinating process which illustrates once again the imagination and ingenuity of man. Who first discovered the process is unknown, though it has been attributed to a blind old monk named Dom Pérignon. Except for the vineyards of the Moselle and the Rheingau in Germany, the vineyards of Champagne are the farthest north. This means that the growing season is very short, and in order for the grape to increase its sugar content, harvesting takes place as late as possible in the fall. Once the date for the picking of the grapes has been set, an army of workers streams into the vineyards. Their loads are quickly rushed to the press houses where the grapes are pressed. The juice is then hurried off to the enormous vat rooms of the firms which make champagne. Fermentation now begins. Then the process known as blending takes place, and it is this blending which makes champagne produced by the firm of Tétinger different from the champagne produced by the firm of, say, Bollinger, Mumm, Moët & Chandon, Ruinart, or Krug. Each firm has its own secret formula for blending. And blending is difficult, since each firm tries to make its champagne taste the same from year to year. The new wine is grapey and sweet, and its potential qualities are hidden. One must be able to tell what the wine will taste like once it has matured, and since the sugar content in the grape varies from year to year, you must also know just how much cane sugar must be added, for it is a sugar which during the fermentation process turns to alcohol. The maker of champagne tries to have all of his wines have the same alcoholic content, usually 12% by volume. Here is Monsieur Claude Tétinger, head of the distinguished firm which bears his name, to tell us more about champagne.
Do not forget that the nature of the soil is not the only condition for making champagne. There are also a few other conditions. The climate, for instance, which is very important and which is, of course, very different here from the climate they have in Cognac. And also, the nature of the chalk of the soil in Champagne is unique. This chalk is very spongious. The chalk absorbs the rain waters during winter time. And during summertime, even if the weather is very dry, the roots of the plant will never lack water because they will find all the water they need in the chalky soil. At the beginning of springtime, we bottle this wine. And immediately after the bottling, the fermentation begins. There was first a fermentation in cask to transform the fresh juice into wines. And a second fermentation will take place inside the bottle to transform the still wine of Champagne into a sparkling wine. To have the sediment slipping to the cork, see the way he makes this operation. We call it the remuage, and we call the man a remueur. The bottles are checked one by one till the sediment is completely stuck on the cork.
Yes.
And afterwards, when
how long does that take?
At least 3 months.
3 months? He turns it every day for 3 months?
Absolutely. But these workers are so skilled and so fast worker that they can shake easily more than 60,000 bottles per day.
60,000.
At fantastic spins.
Yes. Yes. Then after 3 months of turning the bottles every day, what happens?
The work has been completely performed. We have now to take off the sediment without losing the wine. See that big, large refrigerator. In that refrigerator, we immerge only the cork and the bottleneck of the bottles.
You mean the bottle is put inside into this refrigerator upside down to freeze the neck of the bottle?
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's right. Only the cork and the bottlenecks are immersed in the freezing mixture. After 2 or 3 minutes, a piece of ice will obstruct the bottleneck. You see, the sediment is kept prisoner between the cork and the piece of ice. The man sees that worker. We call him a dégorgeur. He wants now to take off the sediment without losing the wine.
Yes, which is the sediment which is now trapped in the ice.
Absolutely. So he will put the bottle upright again. He will extract the cork. The sediment will leave with the cork, but not the wine, which will remain inside the bottle. And very quickly, the worker will put another cork on the wine, on the bottle, to prevent the wine now to follow the sediment.
You do not add another bit of wine to take up the space that the ice had?
Yes, we have to, because we have lost some of the wine.
By March, all of the wine has been bottled, each with its special dose of cane sugar. The bottles have been sealed with a temporary cork held in place by a steel wire clamp. The bottles are stored in the deep chalk cellars hundreds of feet underground, where the temperature is low and constant. Up above the chalk cellars, spring is slowly arriving in the upper world. The sap rises in the vines. Buds begin to appear on the trees. The earth softens under the rain and warming sun. And in the dark cellars, at the same time, a second fermentation takes place within the bottle. Why this should happen at precisely this time, no one exactly knows. It is an extraordinary phenomena. It is something to sing about. Sugar dissolved in wine is added to the now sparkling clean liquid in the bottle. The amount of sugar added depends upon the type of champagne desired: brut, extra dry, or sec. Tastes in wines obviously change. Today the demand is for a drier champagne.
Here to tell us more about champagne is Count de Chandon-Mouette. Would you be kind enough to tell us what you think of swizzle sticks that people use so very often to chase the bubbles from champagne?
Well, I believe it is a pity, because it has taken about 17 centuries to invent the way of making a good sparkling champagne, and that it is a pity that with the swizzle sticks, in a few seconds, all the bubbles have gone away.
How about the temperature at which champagne should be served? How long would you leave it in the refrigerator?
Well, probably 2 hours maximum, I suppose, before you want to drink it.
And you think that leaving it too long, let us say for a couple of weeks in the refrigerator, just is not good for the wine?
I think it would spoil it.
If
the wine is too cold, you completely lose the flavor.
Do you believe in drinking champagne young, or rather choosing a vintage that is some 10 or 12 years old?
Well, I prefer drinking champagne which are young, because with the fact that the bottle has been opened for the disgorging, it ages rather rapidly, and I think 10 years is the maximum in the life of a good champagne. Otherwise, you are apt to find wines that get flat and the cork
yes, but
resist.
Now, what would you do insofar as your very famous Dom Pérignon, which is sometimes older than that?
Our Dom Pérignon cuvée, which is a cuvée de prestige, of course, age rather older because it matures in the cellars before disgorging. And to have a good wine, it has to remain a long time in the cellars, and it's usually very good vintages.
It becomes that much more mellow, that much rounder.
It becomes more mellow and better to the taste. And having only been disgorged before shipment, you don't have the danger
of
drinking it to oxidation.
A single bottle of champagne takes 4 years to prepare. It is handled by 84 different people from the cellar to the shipping crate. No wonder champagne is necessarily an expensive wine, and I believe a good champagne is worth every penny. Champagne, the drink of lovers, the drink of wine lovers across the world. We are in the ancient monastery of Klosterebbebach, in the heart of the Rhineland, which produces some of the greatest white wines in all of the world. This section is called the Rheingau. It begins near the city of Wiesbaden and extends in a great sweep 20 miles along the Rhine to the little town of Rüdesheim. The vineyards are planted on the slopes above the Rhine and face due south, catching the rays of the sun all day long. The river itself acts like a mirror reflecting light and heat over the vineyards. We are very far north, as far as vineyards are concerned. The Rheingau is on the same latitude as Winnipeg in Canada, and it is this fact which brings distinction to the white wines of this remarkable area of Germany. Here the white grape, the Riesling grape, matures late in the fall when the sweetness of the grape is at its highest point. As in the making of the wines of Sauternes, these white German wines, the best of them anyway, in exceptional vintages, are made from the grapes which have been attacked by what is called noble rot. These overripe grapes are picked individually from the clusters during harvest and are fermented separately. Certain German words are helpful to know in choosing one of these fine wines. Words like Spätlese, which literally means late harvest, or Auslese, which means selected and picked apart from the rest of the harvest. The rarest sweet wines are Bärenauslesen and Trockenbärenauslesen, which simply means overripe and dried overripe grapes. These last wines are of an astonishing quality and sometimes sell for $20 or $30 a bottle or even more. It is important to know how to read a label on a fine German wine. It is really quite simple. The information given is very precise. The long, difficult-to-pronounce names are simply the names of villages, followed by the names of the vineyards where the grapes are grown. Hattenheimer is a wine from the town of Hattenheim. Sometimes, the longer the name, the better the wine, for only the meaningful quality factors are mentioned. The wine is apt to be better when both the name of the town and the name of the vineyard is printed on the label. For instance, a Rüdesheimer Schlossberg is better than a Rüdesheimer by itself. Schlossberg on the label means that the grapes have come from the vineyard of Schlossberg or Castle Hill. The more precise the label, the better the wine usually. You may also read the vintage year telling us when the grapes were grown. Originalabfüllung means original estate bottling, and sometimes the grape variety may be added, such as Riesling. Here is the manager of State Domain, the greatest state-owned vineyard in the Rheingau. His cellars, his offices, and the vats are all housed in this immensely impressive 13th century monastery, known as Klosterebbebach.
Now, my title is actually Weinbau Director. That means viticultural director. We are here, the Rheingauer Hessian State Domains.
How large is the state domain?
It's actually the biggest wine farm in Germany, with 160 hectares vineyards and 40 hectares other lands like forest and so forth. And if you compare this figure with the average of a German wine farm, then you can realize how big it is, because the average is only 0.7 hectares, that means 2 acres.
Would you be kind enough to give us the history of this fabulous Cistercian monastery? When was it started?
Now, it was founded by French monks in 1135, and in the Middle Age, Kloster Eberbach was the richest and biggest wine merchant in the whole Middle Europe. They owned over 200 wine estates, and their cellars went as far as Köln, where they had the biggest cellar. And 1866, it was taken over by the Prussian, and since then, it is owned by the state.
The best known of German wines has no right to be famous at all. I'm referring, of course, to Liebfraumilch. It means, literally, milk of the loving woman. Actually, it is any wine from any place in the Rhine-Hessen district, and is usually of inferior quality. But now I want you to meet the owner of one of the greatest vineyards of the Rheingau, Prince von Metternich, owner of Schloss Johannisberg.
Paul, what can you tell us about German wines?
Well, the main characteristic of German wines, I think, is that we mostly have white wines. Those are the ones that are known, not only now, but since many, many years, and to the general public and in the world. And I would say the principal regions of these white wines are the Rheingau, the Rhine-Hessen, the Palatinate, and the Moselle.
What would be the main characteristic of German wines?
Well, I think that the main characteristic of German white wines is a certain acidity. It comes especially, I would say, from the Riesling grapes, and it keeps the wine rather young, a little bit like people also remain young if they manage to remain nimble, although their age, advanced age. I think that nowadays lots of things have to be that way. Everything is getting lighter, like maybe people are getting lighter, the suits are getting lighter, the shoes are getting lighter, the motor cars are getting lighter. And I think that's one of the principal sides of these German wines, is that they are lighter, and they are lighter through this acidity that keeps them young although they're old age.
How about vintages?
Well, vintages are very important, because there's a great difference between years with a lot of sun, that means very good years, and years with less sun. Because one shouldn't forget that these wines grow in a very northern part of Europe, and I think they are the wines that are growing in the most, in the northernest part of the world. Therefore, the difference between a sunny summer and a not so sunny one can be very great.
There's a great deal of interest always raised about which wine goes with which food. What do you personally believe?
Well, I personally believe that white wine can go through the whole meal perfectly well. And one can also have a white wine, fresh white wine, before meals as an aperitif.
In Germany, a great deal of people drink wine in the middle of the afternoon, or for that matter, just the way one would drink whiskey, without any food at all. Is that true?
Yes, it is, Alex. It is true. And I think it's quite a good idea. You have many places in Germany, in many villages, where you can go and have a drink of white wine, just the same as you go and have a beer. You don't have to eat anything. If you want to, you can have a pretzel or something. But I mean, it isn't necessary to eat anything. You drink like anybody else, like you say, would have had a whiskey.
And now we are in Rüdesheim, in a little cobbled alley lined with Weinstubes. Wine rooms or wine parlors, where people come to drink Rhine wine and to listen to music, to dance and to sing.
Ein fröhliches Leben hat noch niemand bereut. Ein fröhliches Leben hat noch niemand bereut.
Ein fröhlicher Mensch wird geliebt überall. Wohin er auch kommt, ist er gern gesehen. Für ihn singt ein Spatz wie die Nachtigall. Nie wird er das Leben verschmähen. Er gibt uns einen Rat. den beherzigt hat. Halte das Glück fest, wenn es dir winkt.
There are many sounds connected with wine. One of these I'm sure you never expected to hear. The sound of an auctioneer calling out the bids he receives from agents here in the Rheingau to purchase the new Rhine wines.
Schönheitsbietlese 20, 60, 70 zum ersten und 26, 70 zum zweiten und 26, 70, 80, 90, 27, 10. 27,10 zum ersten, 27,10 zum zweiten und 27,10 zum dritten Karres 2000.
Once a single bottle of wine was auctioned off for $80. For all its seriousness, wine is a happy business, especially the drinking of wine.
Wer hat nicht mal am Rhein in lauer Sommernacht ein Glas Wein vom Glück träumen zugebracht.
We cannot leave the subject of German wines without talking of a wine which comes from the most picturesque and spectacular section of Germany, the Moselle Valley. In this section, the Moselle runs through a deep gorge, and the very steep slopes which arise up from the river are covered with vineyards. They are placed so precariously that it is impossible to work them either by horse or tractor. Everything is done by human hand, and to watch the workers in the vineyard is like watching mountain climbers scaling the Mont Blanc. The slate soil gives the character to these very light wines. There are many great Moselles. Among them, Piesbotter, Wehlener, Bernkastler are excellent for their bouquet, delicacy, breed, and lightness. Wines from the Rheinhessen, the Rheingau, and that section called the Palatinate are sold in brown bottles, but those of the Moselle come in green bottles. Certainly an easy mark of identification. I advise you to take a chance when you're in a wine shop. You will discover that fine German white wines are among the best in the world. Probably the best known and most popular of Italian wines is Chianti. Here is Bettino Ricassoli to tell us about this popular red wine and also about Chianti Classico, the aristocrat of Chiantis.
Chianti is a hilly district south of Florence. On its sunny slopes is produced a high-quality red wine, well known since centuries all over the world. This wine was called, from the name of the area, Chianti. Chianti Classico is a rich, garnet color when aged, red wine with a characteristic full and warm taste and a particularly agreeable and fine bouquet. It is a full-bodied wine, although not heavy, slightly tannic but not astringent, dry but not harsh. It develops its full qualities, becoming mellower and with a finer and increased bouquet, after having aged at least 2 or 3 years. Chianti Classico can age many years in the bottle, continually improving. Regular Chianti, instead, is a lively, somewhat tart, ruby red wine, normally with not much bouquet, but tasty and agreeable with rich food. It is a wine to drink young. The wicker-covered bottle, generally used for Chianti, especially for export, is very popular, as you say, but it is also very unpractical and expensive. More still, it gives a cheap appearance to the wine contained in it. This happens also because all the cheap Chiantis are marketed only in such container. As a matter of fact, the best Chiantis are always sold, in Italy at least, also and progressively more in regular bottles. With regard to the appellation contrôlée laws, which are on the way to be applied also in Italy, this will limit the quantities of wine sold with place names and also will allow a better selection of the wines themselves. Therefore, appellation wines will grow in price and in quality, and a distinction will be operated on the market between these and the ones with lower quality standards.
Then there is another wine from Italy, which has grown to immense popularity in recent years. I'm referring to Suave, S-O-A-V-E, which comes from the neighborhood of Verona in northern Italy. It is not a great wine, but it is pale, dry, and fresh, and a delightful white wine. Another good wine of the region is the red wine known as Valpolicella. It is tender and soft and has grown increasingly popular in America. And now a few of the wines of Spain. It is not generally known that Spain ranks third in the production of the world's wine. We all know about sherry, that excellent aperitif. In Spain, the sherry which is the most popular is called fino. It is very dry and light, but in bullfighting circles, a very special kind of sherry is drunk, which I find truly excellent. It is among the driest wines in the world and is called manzanilla or manzanilla. These aperitifs are available in the United States, and they are certainly worth trying. But sherry is not really a table wine. I mean, one does not drink it throughout the dinner. Surely one of the best dinner wines is what the Spaniards called Rioja, R-I-O-J-A. It is logical to proceed from the wines of Spain to the wines of another area rich in Spanish tradition, the wines of California. The best vineyards of California are in the San Francisco Bay Area. The best California wine, which is produced in very small quantity, is consumed locally and is rarely distributed nationally. It is worth a trip to San Francisco simply to savor these delightful wines. San Francisco is one of the most cosmopolitan, sophisticated, and beautiful cities in the world. The land which has yielded the wine bonanza for California wine growers are in the Livermore Valley and in the Napa Valley. More and more California growers are learning not to name their wines after their European counterparts. A California Burgundy or a California Chablis or even a California Sauterne has little to do with the European wines also named Burgundy, Chablis or Sauterne, except perhaps that their color is similar. More and more California growers are throwing away European names and referring to the variety of the grape from which the wine is made. For example, you're apt to read on the label of a bottle of California wine the words Pinot Noir or Cabernet Sauvignon, and these refer to the variety of the grapes used. These wines are called by experts varietal wines. Today, California growers are faced with the task of being able to compete with the European market, and to my mind, this can only be done with varietal wines, not imitations. For instance, the Cabernet Sauvignon from Northern California has outproduced in terms of quality some of the best red wines of Italy, Spain, and Portugal, and attains even a fuller wine than that made from the same variety in Chile. There are excellent American wines made in California. Here again is my friend Dr. Maynard Amerine to tell you more about them.
There is now available lots of information about planting better varieties of grapes in California, planting them in the proper region, which we've emphasized for the last 30 years, using the best modern techniques of fermentation and aging. And the proof that we are succeeding, that we have succeeded, is how fine California wines have become, how the prices have increased, how the supply has not been able to keep up with the demand. Yes, we'll produce finer wines in California, and we will produce lots more of them in the future. They won't be like other wines because they will be California wines.
At state dinners in the White House, California wines have been served to visiting heads of state. So far as is known, there have been no complaints from these gentlemen.
Tell me, which of these wine regions in France?
So you're having a dinner party, and of course you're serving wine. Now, drinking wine is one of life's great pleasures, and about pleasure there's no hard and fast rule. Do what pleases your palate. Experience has taught us, however, that white wine, a dry white wine, tastes best before drinking the red wines. We also know that certain wines go best with certain foods. A white wine, a fine white Burgundy, such as Chassagne Montrachet, or a white Grave, goes well with fish or chicken, and a Châteauneuf du Pape, or a Gevrey Chambertin, or a good red Bordeaux, goes gloriously with red meats. Did you know that the best vehicle for bringing out the taste of red wine is cheese? Cheese and wine were made for one another. It is a happy marriage. I would now like to talk with James Beard, the outstanding authority on food and wine. What are the outstanding points you tell your students about cooking with wine?
Well, there are four or five of them, Alexis. First of all, and most important, I emphasize the fact that there is no such thing as a cooking wine. Any wine that is good to drink is good to cook with. Secondly, I believe that the better the wine, the better the dish, and that you should use the same wine in your cooking that you're going to drink with the dish later on. After all, you're using perhaps a half a cup, or two-thirds of a cup, or whatever it may be, of wine. You can certainly spare that much from your drinking wine to use in your cooking. Thirdly, people are so apt to think that if a little wine is good, a great deal is better, and they may drown a dish with the wine. They should follow the recipe, which is a formula for a blend of flavors, more than anything else. And last but not least, people should not just pour wine into a saucepan or a casserole or a sautoir and then serve it at once. To get the full blend of flavor from wine in cookery, the wine must cook long enough to release the alcohol fumes and thereby leave the fine flavor of the grape.
Jim, don't you think that there's much too much emphasis on this marriage of food and wine?
Oh, of course there is. There's such snobism about wine and the choice of what wine is going to be served with what dish that it sometimes makes the pleasure of drinking wine a rather difficult one. I think that people have forgotten the main rule of eating and drinking, and that is that you eat and drink to enjoy. And your wine should be the wine that you want, that appeals to your palate, and not something that a so-called, quote, expert, unquote, has told you you must have with a certain dish. If I want a white wine with a goose, I'm going to have a white wine with a goose. If I want a red wine with fish, I'm afraid I'm going to do it, if I'm pleased to do it. And I'm going to defy the rules to please my own palate. In the south of France, or if you're in Florida, or in the Caribbean, you certainly are not going to want the choicest red wines for most of your meals. You're going to want a good, pleasing, happy white wine, or a very light red wine, which you might even, in some cases, cool slightly when you are drinking it.
When you're serving a fine dinner with fine wines, you ought to pamper your taste buds. Strong cocktails and smoking dulls these taste buds, and you'll be unable to fully savor the pleasure which awaits you. Sour or tart foods spoil the taste of wines. Salad with vinegar is bad with any wine. So now that you're forewarned, we can open a bottle of fine red wine. You must be careful not to disturb the sediment which is at the bottom of the bottle. When you cut off the top foil, and when you insert the corkscrew, care must be taken. After the bottle has been opened, wipe the lips so that no dirt nor bits of cork fall into the precious liquid. This is one of the reasons that the host pours a little of the wine into his glass first. If any of the cork has fallen into the wine, it will remain in the host's glass. You know that red wine should be served at room temperature, and white wine should be cooled. These are not matters of etiquette, but they are suggestions based on horse sense for greater enjoyment.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. That wraps it up for this edition of Hear It Wow. The Big Picture will be back next week. Lisa Nichols will be back with me, and we'll be bringing you all of the news. Until then, stay safe, everybody.